Welcome back. This is our third in a series of four on truth decay, why truth is under attack, why it matters, and what we can do about it. Before we turn to that, next Sunday we will have little bookmarks, which has become a tradition here, that describe the July seminar series, which will be on bringing good news to the poor, poverty in the United States. We have three guest speakers during July, taking off the weekend of July 4th. First weekend in July, close to July 4th, and that will reconvene. So we will continue in July, is the point, with another set of speakers. So welcome. Let's begin with a prayer, and we'll start. Oh, gracious God, we thank you for this time together, this beautiful day when we can be outside to worship you and gather here in spirit and in truth. Bless our time together and always help us to discern the word that you would have us know and help us to live faithfully in your truth. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so you may have heard that the Department of Justice came out with a report this week. Just for fun, I'm only saying this in passing. I'm not going to dwell on it or dwell on substance very much. But just for fun, the night the report came out, it was, what, two nights ago maybe? I was flipping back and forth between Fox News and MSNBC. And I was getting dizzy, and I had like, and if I didn't know better, I would have thought they were talking about two entirely different documents. You ever do that? I mean, it's astonishing. It would not surprise you to know that the Fox News report showed that it totally slammed the FBI, totally pointed in the direction of exonerating the president. It was all about how corrupt and messed up the FBI is. MSNBC's take was that, yeah, there were some isolated problems, but basically the bottom line was Comey was insubordinate, but he didn't do anything criminal. It wasn't politically motivated. And by the way, if there was any political impact, it benefited Trump, not Clinton, because, you know, he announced, well, we got some stuff we're looking into about Clinton. And then he says, no, we're not going to prosecute. And then he says 10 days before the election, oh, by the way, there's more stuff. And then 2 days before the election, oh, never mind. So if you listen to Fox, you would think, here's a slamming indictment of the FBI and how corrupt and incompetent it is. You listen to MSNBC, it basically says, yep, everything's okay. So I read the Wall Street Journal every day, and the New York Times, and the Post-Gazette. So the journals, which again accounts for a lot of Tylenol. So the journals cover headline on the first day was, report blasts FBI agents, Comey over Clinton probe. So big bold letters, report blasts. Post-Gazette, top of the full front page, watchdog report, Comey, quote, insubordinate but not biased. So lead commentary with the headlines on both of those. The next day, which is actually Saturday and Sunday for the journal, which as you know is not a left-leaning publication. So quotes Trump as saying, I've been totally exonerated, Mr. Trump said, in reference to the Inspector General's report, even though it made no mention of the president's conduct or the Russia investigation. The report described Mr. Comey as insubordinate and documented politically charged and anti-Trump messages, but the report found no evidence that the outcome of the Clinton email probe was affected by political bias. This is the actual report of the journal. Now, I don't want to go into any detail on all of that, but my point in saying all this is simply that here's a document that came out, and depending on your news source, you get wildly different headlines and somewhat different interpretation of the substance. But if you drill down, a sort of center-right publication like the Wall Street Journal actually describes rather fairly what the report said, even though the day before the headline was, report blasts FBI agents. So this is all just by way of saying what we all know, which is that people can live in their own little ideological cocoons, surrounded by like-minded friends, listening to news sources that reinforce what they already believe. And if you do that, it's possible to have wildly different interpretations, not only about what's going on, but about the very same document. So welcome to our world. This is part of why this whole conversation about truth and truth decay really matters. Now, title for today is Tribes and Truthiness, and those who watch late-night television will recognize the term truthiness from Stephen Colbert. We'll come to that in a minute. The first week, we sort of introduced the whole topic, used the example of tax cuts as an issue that people are divided on, where there's sort of ideology and there are facts, and trying to point out the importance of the difference between ideology and facts. Last week, we talked about a field guide to logical fallacies, and several people asked me to print that up. I didn't do it for today. I just didn't have time, but I will eventually, because the concept was some of us sit out on our back porch with a field guide to birds, and we watch for, you know, the ruby-throated hummingbird and the red-winged blackbird and stuff. You could sit watching the television with a field guide to fallacies and pick out all kinds of abundant species on the television, in newspapers, and so forth. So it's a if it weren't about real things, it would be sort of entertaining. But eventually I'll print that up and you can have your little field guide handy for wherever you, whenever you watch the television news. Today, we want to come to tribes and truthiness, and the subtitle here is about how our lesser commitments can sometimes get in the way of our commitment to the truth. That's to say, how subordinate loyalties can shape what we're willing and able to see and hear about the truth, about the way things really are. And just to be mildly clever, I've taken the title Tribes and Truthiness, which I'll explain in a minute about Stephen Colbert's work. So let's begin with tribes. I'm going to define tribes for our purposes as groups that people associate with for the purposes of belonging, identity, material benefit, worldview, and validation. You could unpack that at some length. But there's a lot of talk about tribes these days, lots of books about it, lots of commentary. It turns out that people are deeply tribal creatures. We like to affiliate with groups for all these kinds of reasons. And some tribes are about economic interests, some are social, some are political, some are ethnic, some are national. But we have all kinds of affiliations for these kinds of purposes. Truthiness is a word coined by Stephen Colbert in his broadcast on October 17, 2005. This is from Wikipedia, which I hasten to add, if any student at Carnegie Mellon gives me a paper citing Wikipedia, they get marked down severely. So I understand Wikipedia is not a definitive source. That said, however, for pop culture things, it's not a bad place to go. So Wikipedia's summary of truthiness is the belief or assertion that a particular statement is true based on the intuition or perception of some individual or individuals without, is a key part, without regard to evidence, logic, intellectual examination, or facts. That's a pretty big disclaimer, right? So Stephen Colbert, back in 2005, was talking about sort of people's idea of truthiness. Well, it kind of feels like it should be true. And he said a lot of people live on the basis of their idea of truthiness, kind of feels right to me, without examining any sort of evidence or logic or facts. Just, yeah, it feels okay to me. It feels kind of truthy, so I'm going to believe it. And I put this in particularly because Colbert, you know, Colbert's a Catholic, and he has a sort of Catholic background and knows some Latin. So he says a more academic term for truthiness is veritasiness. And I thought that was wonderful because our own youth group is called Veritas, which, of course, is the Latin word for truth. So the ordinary folk would simply call this truthiness. Latin scholars would, of course, call it veritasiness. All right? Now, here's my thesis. That people are inclined to believe the truthiness of their tribes, understood in this way, implicitly reflecting short-term self-interest. We have tribes in that they predispose us to believe certain things, and we belong to those tribes in part because we're already predisposed to believe what the tribe believes. So, I want to claim that people are inclined to believe the truthiness in this kind of tongue-in-cheek definition that Colbert lifts up, implicitly, not explicitly, reflecting short-term self-interest. Because when people claim that things are true, they really claim that they're true, and they probably believe that they're true. Remember on the very first day, those of you who were here, we said that people believe lots of things that aren't true. I think lies, in the sense of things that people aren't know are not true, but they say them anyway, are a relatively small proportion of the untrue things people believe. Most of the time, people believe things that aren't true, but they sincerely believe that they're true, for all kinds of reasons that we've already talked about. So, thesis here is that people are inclined to believe the truthiness of their tribes implicitly reflecting short-term self-interest. We tend to believe stuff that suits our interest in the short term, but we do that implicitly, not explicitly, because the whole way it works depends on our believing this really is the case. Most people do not say, I prefer to see the world in this way because it benefits my short-term self-interest. Nobody ever says that. But if you look at why people believe what they believe and how they talk about it, you see that that's absolutely a pattern, and the pattern only works if it's implicit, not explicit. Okay? So, I have three examples, none of which do I want to try to resolve the substance of. But we're going to take three sort of controversial subjects. Again, not to decide the substance of those subjects, but because it's only controversial subjects in which people have a stake, that you get this truthiness thing, where different people, depending on their tribes and their interests, see things in different ways. So our purpose here is to talk about how people think and talk about these things, not to resolve the substance of them. You follow me? So the first of the three topics is the federal budget, which we did not look at the budget in the first week, but we looked at the whole idea of tax cuts and deficits. So this is going to look ludicrously simple, but that's kind of the point. Income minus expense equals surplus or deficit. All right? Everybody with me? This is money in. This is money out. If this is bigger than that, you have a surplus. If this is bigger than that, you have a deficit. Yeah. You with me? Okay. Now, to oversimplify vastly, I mentioned on the first day, I actually have a sort of master's level study of economics, micro and macro, and public policy and that sort of thing. But just for fun, economists sometimes talk loosely about the things that government spends money on as being guns and butter. Guns meaning national defense stuff, butter being all the kind of social stuff. Obviously, it's just sort of introductory placeholder language. And now, in our time, for reasons that we'll see, debt. So the expansion of this income minus expense equals surplus equation is the income is, broadly speaking, a function of some kind of tax rate times whatever the base is that that rate operates on. That's where your income comes from. Now, this is very simplified, of course, because you have lots and lots of bases, you have lots and lots of rates, you have income taxes, business taxes, import taxes, tariffs, a word that we're all paying attention to these days. So this is oversimplified, of course, but just to keep the concept easy, income comes from some kind of tax rate, a little bit from fees, but most of the government's income doesn't come from fees. Most of it's some kind of rate multiplied by some kind of base, that's your income, minus what you spend on guns, national defense, what you spend on butter, everything else, plus the debt. Okay? Now, here's an example of fiscal year 2017, which would be last fiscal year. Remember, we said the federal fiscal year runs from October 1st through September 30th. And so this is fiscal 2017. And briefly, you can see sort of in round percentages where the federal money goes in. And these charts increasingly are incorporating Social Security. Some of us remember 15, 20 years ago when they talked about Social Security lockbox and keeping all that separate and so forth. That language has sort of largely disappeared. So Social Security, of course, has its own revenue stream, but it's typically lumped in with the larger spending. So you can see fairly quickly, Social Security is about 24% of federal spending. Medical expenditures, including Medicare, net of offsetting receipts, 15%. Medicaid, the Children's Health Program, health insurance subsidies, including the Affordable Care Act subsidies, all this stuff is about 11%. So together, about 26% of federal expenditures, a little over a quarter, is spent on healthcare, right? So slightly under a quarter on Social Security, slightly over a quarter on medical stuff. Income securities like TANF, temporary assistance, disability payments and whatnot, other than Social Security. Non-defense discretionary is sort of everything else that the government has some flexibility about. Defense discretionary is essentially the Pentagon budget. As you'll see in a minute, the current national budget is something on the order of $4 trillion. So 15% of that is about $600 billion, plus or minus, is what we spend on national defense. Interest, now this is why there's a debt piece in the formula. Net interest is 7%. You'll see in a few minutes, that's a lot of money, 7% on $4 trillion. And then there's a little bit of mandatory stuff, so it all adds up to roughly $4 trillion. Okay, this is where the money went in fiscal 17. It's not wildly different this year. So back to our little chart here. Income minus expenses surplus, rate times base minus guns and butter and debt equals surplus or deficit. Please don't be insulted. You'd be astonished how many people don't get this. So deficits happen when expenses are bigger than income. Now, this is a very smart group, so I won't dwell on that. But the reason for pointing it out is you will sometimes hear people say, we're running a deficit because we're spending too much on X. Well, it's just arithmetic. You're running a deficit whenever this is bigger than that. Pure and simple, right? So if somebody says, we're running a deficit because we're spending too much on healthcare, well, yeah, that's part of the butter. But there's other parts of the butter, and there are guns, and there are debt, which you're going to see in a minute is more than $300 billion. And if there was enough revenue to cover it, we wouldn't have a deficit. So this is why this is important. Depending on your prejudice, people will say, the problem is this. No, a dollar is a dollar is a dollar. A dollar in offsets a dollar out, no matter what that dollar is spent for. You see the point? So what looks like an absurdly silly thing to point out is in fact not silly at all, because people, depending on their tribe, will cherry pick the piece of the problem that they want to talk about as if the problem wasn't fundamentally one of arithmetic. If you put out more than you bring in, you got a deficit, right? So this is from the first week, so I won't belabor it. But remember, we talked about tax cuts as a policy thing, and the promise was that we will cut taxes and that will so stimulate the economy that they will pay for themselves. This is what actually happened. This data is from the Federal Reserve. So this, I would argue, is in the category of fact, right? The deficit, the tax cuts will pay for themselves is in the category of principle, belief, ideology. George Herbert Walker Bush called it voodoo economics in the Republican primary of 1980. The claim is we're going to cut taxes. It will so stimulate the economy, they'll pay for themselves. Here's what actually happened, okay? Carter had about $78 billion in deficits. Reagan said we're going to cut taxes. That prompted the voodoo economics comment. Here are the deficits. Bush 41 was George Herbert Walker Bush himself. In the 8 years of Clinton, remember, started out with a Democratic Congress, then Newt Gingrich and the gang came in. So Gingrich and the House on the one hand and Clinton on the other for 8 years managed to cut the deficits to zero, and we actually had 4 years of surplus. Followed then by the Bush 43 tax cuts, and then at the end of W's administration, remember the floor fell out of the economy, Lehman Brothers, all that kind of stuff happened, and then we had massive, massive deficits, which then Obama inherited, started to cut back a little bit, but even towards the latter part of Obama's administration, we were still at the level that we were roughly during Bush 43. So that's all just by way of reminder, okay? And this is the consequence. This is what happened to the debt. Here's Reagan tax cuts. Here's 41 tax cuts. Here's Clinton, things sort of leveling off a little bit between Clinton and Gingrich. And then here's W, and here's the floor falling out. And this stops at about 2009 or 10. Today, it would be up around $14 trillion or so. Okay? So these are just facts. These are indisputable facts about what happened. Okay? So that brings us back to our simple chart again. Deficits can be reduced by increasing income, decreasing expenses, or some combination of the two. Pretty sure I haven't lost you, right? Which is what you saw during that period when Clinton was in the White House and Gingrich was running the Congress, and they said, let's figure out some combination of controlling spending and cutting taxes, and guess what happened? They balanced the budget, okay? Now, here is the proposed spending for fiscal year 18, which we're in now. That's the year ending September 30th, 2018. And this one is presented in a different way, not percentages of the total budget, but actual dollars. And I apologize, it's a little bit fuzzy. I couldn't find a simple diagram that was a little clearer than this. But here's the thing. Deficits currently are running in the neighborhood of $600 billion. Plus or minus. As a senator famously said, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon you're talking real money. So the deficits are currently running around $600 billion. When somebody says no new taxes, well, let me just tell you. Our recently departed Congressman Tim Murphy signed Grover Norquist's pledge, Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax, what's it called? Americans for Tax something. Almost all the Republicans in the House and the Senate signed Grover Norquist's pledge, the gist of which was no net increase in taxes. If you're going to increase taxes in some place, you got to cut them in some other place, so there's no net increase in taxes. So Mr. Murphy signed the pledge, no net increases in taxes, and said he supported a balanced budget amendment. So here's the question. If you're spending about $4 trillion a year, and you're running $600 billion deficits, and you're not going to increase taxes in the aggregate, what's left? You either have to believe that the tax cuts will generate so much revenue that they will pay for themselves and solve the budget problem, see preceding slides, or you guys say, all right, where are we going to take $600 billion out of here? Well, think of that. Medicaid is only $404 billion. Medicare is $582 billion. Social Security is the biggest thing at roughly $1 trillion. And, of course, Social Security has its own income stream through the FICA and SICA taxes. So where are you going to cut $600 billion from the budget? Okay, so that brings us back to this. Can spending cuts alone balance a $600 billion deficit? I'm just going to leave the question there. We'll talk about it for a minute if you want to. But my point in bringing all this up is there are facts and there are opinions. There are ideologies. There are, one might say there's wishful thinking. But eventually ideologies and wishful thinking run aground on facts. You saw the charts. They're right out of the Federal Reserve Board. They're indisputable facts. Here's an example I want to say of where people's tribes tend to shape the truthiness that they will subscribe to. And it's a fair thing to ask whether the truthiness corresponds with the facts. And why does it matter? Well, we're already, back here, we're already spending, where is net? $315 billion goes for nothing at all except to pay the interest on the debt. Neither guns nor butter. That $315 billion isn't building up our national defense. It's not paying for anybody's health care. It's not paving streets. It's not building sewers. It's just, and it's not retiring the debt. It's just paying interest on the debt. $315 billion a year. And by the way, if we keep doing that, that one chart's going to keep rising. And who's going to get this? Our grandkids. Perhaps you've heard, I had a grandchild recently. I think I mentioned that. I'm telling you, this is a visceral thing for me. This is causing me to think, I've always thought about these things, but this is causing me to feel about this stuff in a way that I really didn't before. I'm just going to say it. This generation is arguably being massively irresponsible in wanting things that we're not willing to pay for, racking up the national debt, and passing it on to our grandchildren. I don't see any other way to say it. It's massively irresponsible. And certain tribes have their ideology that tells them, well, let's just cut taxes more because everybody likes tax cuts, and it will pay for itself. We have close to 50 years of history and data to show us it's just not true. So let me pause there for a second. And I don't have any solutions for this, except back to the little diagram. If expense is bigger than income and you have a deficit, you either need to spend less or get more in or some combination of the two. It's just arithmetic. It's not even complicated. The policy problem, of course, is figuring out where to spend less, how to get more revenue, and how to balance things. Let me pause for a second, see if anybody has a comment on that, because I've got another issue for you in a minute. Comments? I'm not suggesting that we can solve this now. Our purpose in this conversation is to show how people think and talk about these things, driven in part by their tribal affiliations and self-interest. Please, Ellie.
More people are working and less people are being
If more people are working and there are fewer people to support, well, actually, so what Ellie's saying is if there are more people to work and fewer people to support, that should bring in more taxes. In principle, that would be true. But first of all, I think what the Social Security Administration worries about is exactly the opposite problem. Not enough people making enough money to pay for all us baby boomers. I turned 66 in March. I'm encouraging my son and daughter-in-law to have lots and lots of children. but it's going to take them 20 years. There's a lag time here, right? In the short run, we kind of have the opposite problem. We have this massive boomer generation retiring and not enough Gen Xers and millennials and others to pay for us. In the long run, might that all work itself out? Probably. But almost certainly what needs to happen is some adjustment in the payouts in Social Security while we're building up the income from the labor force. And by the way, the devil and God are always in the details, right? In the abstract, you can always make an argument that's plausible. Just cut taxes, it'll stimulate the economy so much it'll pay for itself. Well, that's completely plausible in the abstract. But God and the devil are in the details. You've seen what actually happened. Because the stimulative effect of the tax cuts wasn't enough to generate the promised revenue to cover the deficit. Barb? Scott Walker, did he balance the budget? I think he did. Well, the controversy, part of the controversy about Scott Walker, of course, in Wisconsin, is that he took on a whole bunch of unions, including public service employees, did a lot of stuff to cut expenses, but a lot of people who benefited from some of those protections in the unions and so forth were upset about that. It's the same old problem. Yes, of course you can do it. As we said, it's just arithmetic. You can slash spending and balance the budget. But what I'm asking in the federal budget is, if you're running a $600 billion deficit, where are you going to find $600 billion? In the state, he managed to do that on a smaller scale, largely by curbing state spending and particularly unions. Comment, please.
Can you make a clarification? It's important
here.
Sure. Scott Walker is not the one who balanced the budget. I believe it's the governor of Minnesota.
Oh, is that right?
That's what I
Minnesota. Oh, Minnesota. Scott Walker did not? Oh, okay. That's good to know. All right. So, clarification. All right. Unless anybody has anything else to say about this, again, our purpose is not to solve the problem. It's to show that arithmetically, it's an extremely simple problem, right? You need to bring in as much as you spend. And actually, you should bring in more than you spend because you got $14 trillion in debt that it would be nice to pay down, right? So, arithmetically, it's as simple as it could be. Politically, it's massively complicated. Why? Because people like tax cuts. Nobody likes to run for office saying, bad news, folks, we're going to cut your spending and increase your taxes so we can balance the budget, right? So politicians have a powerful incentive to tell you. And by the way, my life often has a sort of soundtrack. I'm out working at some place like Panera or McDonald's or something, and there's background music. I'm telling you, this morning when I was looking over this the last time, Fleetwood Mac came on with the song Tell Me Lies. Cue the soundtrack. Honest to goodness, I am looking at the thing and out comes Fleetwood Mac, Tell Me Lies, Tell Me Lies, Tell Me Sweet Little Lies. I said, all right, the soundtrack of my life. So, arithmetically simple, politically difficult. Why? Because people don't want to pay stuff. They want to get stuff but not pay for it. And now we're having a massive spree on the national credit card. Is that responsible? I don't think so. Joy? Of course, lots of policy trade-offs here. Not a lot of this is going to something that nobody wants. Almost all the expenditure is going to stuff that somebody wants. And when you take 24% of the budget going to Social Security, I want that. When another big chunk goes to Medicare, I'm going to want that pretty soon. And, you know, Medicaid, 26% of the entire expenditure is for healthcare. And by the way, the American health system is not very efficient in terms of dollars in versus outcomes in health. But that's another story. All right, can we move on?
Yeah.
Oh, please.
One more comment on that that I think about often. That slice that says Medicare, and maybe even Medicaid, could collapse to nothing if perhaps, and this comes under wishful thinking, and we wait in joyful hope. Jesus came back, and we all healed all the sick people.
Right? If Jesus came back, we could heal all the sick people. That's true. The Office of Management and Budget doesn't write that in. It could be very nice for a lot of reasons. It would also probably eliminate the need for defense budget, right? Because
I would think that all the doctors and nurses and pharmaceutical companies would go after him sort of the way.
There are lots of places we could go in this conversation, but we won't. All right, so this is just the federal deficit thing. Again, we're not going to solve that problem here, except to say that arithmetically, it's very simple. You got to make income equal to or greater than expense. The problems are all political. But that's what a democracy does, right? We elect people to solve the problem, supposedly. All right. Mass shootings. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. I'm not even sure that the NRA says this anymore, but they did for lots and lots of time. So let's look at this. Here's the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And by the way, the capitalization is all 18th century capitalization. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's it. The whole shebang. Adopted by Congress September 25th, 1789. Ratified 2 years later, 1791. That's the Second Amendment, right? Which is held to be the foundation for the position of the NRA and the gun lobby more broadly, okay? So, here are some questions. First of all, do we still depend on militias for the security of the state as they did in 1791? Now, remember, not that you remember 1791, remember reading in history about 1791. Does anybody know what kinds of guns they had in 1791? Front loaders, single shot, accurate to maybe 50 yards, takes you a really, really fast, experienced marksman, might be able to do that three times in a minute if you're really, really expert. Rifles, somebody know, I think rifles are just beginning to be invented, rifles being barrels that are spiraled so that a bullet can go farther, faster, and more accurately. All that stuff is just beginning to develop. There's almost no army, right? And there's almost no police force in our modern sense. So the assumption in 1789, 1791 is that you got to have a militia. Every guy in his little cabin needs to have his muzzle loader in case the British come and you got to fight off the British, Lexington and Concord, right? You know all that. So a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state, people need to have arms. And that made total sense in 1789, 1791. Do we still depend on militias for the security of the state? I mean, manifestly not, right? We have a really, really big military, which is why we spend $600 billion on defense. You just saw that, right? And we have police, and we have state troopers. I mean, we got all kinds of levels of domestic and international protection, right? So do we depend on militias, guys grabbing their muzzle loaders off the mantle to ward off the British? I don't think so. That's not how we defend ourselves. The amendment itself, second observation, provides for regulation, a well-regulated militia. So people who want to claim that the right to bear arms is inviolable, well, not even most of those people would say it's without limits. You can't own a tank, right? You can't park a howitzer in your backyard. You can't carry around rocket-propelled grenades, right? I mean, nobody would argue that the right to bear arms is without limit, right? So, clearly, the amendment itself says whatever this militia is, and again, think guys with the muzzle loader over the mantle, ready to pull it off the mantle and go stand off the British at Lexington. Even that, the amendment says, needs to be regulated, right? You got to have some kind of control on that. How much more in a world of massively destructive weapons? You can't keep nukes in your house, right? Your right to bear arms is not without limit. And here's an obvious question. 18th century handheld weapons, we're talking about pistols and rifles mostly, shotguns, were very different from those of the 21st century. Would the framers want modern military-grade weapons in civilian hands, given dramatic changes in the armed forces, policing, and the lethality of the weapons themselves? Now, that's a question. I don't know the answer to that. But the fact is, neither does anybody else, right? Manifestly, Madison, Jefferson, all those people that signed the Bill of Rights and got it passed, and all the states that ratified, manifestly, they did not have these in mind. Why? Because these were just invented a few decades ago, right? This is the Bushmaster XM15, in case you're in the market. This is produced by the Remington Corporation, which, by the way, recently filed for bankruptcy. There are endless variations of these. Just go to Field and Stream, go to any gun shop, you can find all kinds of variations of these things. They're variations of what the Army called AR-15, AR for Army, sort of a later development of Vietnam-era guns. But here are the basic features. Lightweight, relatively small caliber, .223 in this case, but big magazine. The magazine is the part that holds the bullets, for those of you who don't know much about guns. So typical stock magazine is 30 rounds, which means it can fire 30 bullets without reloading, and semi-automatic. Civilians are not allowed to own automatic weapons. Semi-automatic means you have to pull the trigger every time you want a bullet to come out. Automatic means you pull the trigger once and bullets keep coming out. So machine guns are automatic. These things are semi-automatic, right? And they come in all kinds of flexible sizes and variations and scopes and whatnot. But this is what are now called modern sporting arms, modern sporting rifles. They're variations on this. This is an actual model from Bushmaster, which is a brand of Remington. Now, manifestly, Jefferson and Adams didn't have this in mind, right? What they had was slow, single-shot, muzzle-loading, and then, a little bit later on, breech-loading handguns and long guns. They did not have these. So it's a fair question to ask, given the changes in our national policing, in our military, in the fact that if British are probably not going to attack us, Canadians might. If the Canadians just get really ticked off and pour across the border, you know, because Trudeau's kind of smarting right now, right? If the Canadians decide to attack us, they're probably not going to say, grab your muskets, men, and, you know, prepare to stand against the Canadians. This is sort of not how we do stuff anymore. Would the framers have wanted these things to be in the hands of civilians? I don't know. But manifestly, that's not what they had in mind when they passed the amendment, because this kind of stuff did not exist, right? All right, so we've had 152 mass shootings since August 1966. Anybody remember what happened in August 1966? Texas. University of Texas at Austin. Guy climbed up in a tower, shot a bunch of people. First in our memory, first mass shooting in America. 1966, 52 years ago, right? So this is a Washington Post compilation of mass shootings since then. Here's University of Texas at Austin. And the part above the line is people killed. The shadowier part below the line is people wounded. So you just notice a little pattern here. These things have happened a lot. There have been a few years when they didn't happen. Relatively few people killed when they happen. But look down here. The frequency is picking up. Look down here, 2012, 2013. Frequency is picking up and numbers of people killed or wounded picking up. Okay? These are just facts. Now, this is defined, mass shooting defined as four people or more. So some people want to fuss about this. Say, well, you know, why four people? Why not six people? Change the definition to six people and you don't have as many mass shootings. Okay. You can argue the semantics of it. But for the sake of discussion, killing four people at a time is what many organizations are using as a definition. Pick a different definition, obviously get different numbers. But at the definition of four per shooting, four people killed, not wounded, this is what we've had since 1966. And this is just schools. Sandy Hook. You remember Sandy Hook? I mean, do you remember Sandy Hook? Horrible, horrible thing. 20 little kids killed in their school in Connecticut, about half an hour from where my in-laws live. Horrible, horrible, horrible thing. Grip the nation. Surely things are going to be different now. You remember that? Remember that? How many mass shootings ago was that? Look at this. This is Parkland. This is the most recent school shooting. School shooting. Surely things will change. Somebody walks in and kills 20 little kids. Isn't there something we can do about that? Turns out, no, there really isn't. Because the right to bear arms is guaranteed by the Second Amendment. Because there should be no infringement on it. Because guns don't kill people. People kill people, right? So this is the price that we pay for this. Now, are there easy answers to this? Probably not. Are you going to be able to stop all the killings? By the way, mass shootings are a small percentage of homicides in America, and they're even a small percentage of homicide by gun in America. You'll see that in a minute. Very small percentage. The reason they register so much is, of course, that it's horrible. Somebody walks into an elementary school or a high school or a concert or a nightclub or a movie theater, shoots up a bunch of people, makes the news, everybody's horrified. So those are salient. They get a lot of attention. In terms of actual numbers of people killed in homicides and even killed in homicides by guns, they're a very small percentage. So even if you eliminated mass shootings, you wouldn't eliminate all the homicides. My daughter lives in Chicago, where an astonishing number of people get killed all the time, usually one or two at a time, and usually with handguns. So there's no easy way, except perhaps to confiscate everybody's guns, and for a dozen reasons, that's just not going to happen in America. There's no easy way to fix this. But again, our point here is to say, is to observe how people think and talk about this, depending on their tribe, their understanding of sort of truthiness of the situation, and their interests. Here's Wayne LaPierre. He is the executive vice president of the National Rifle Association. Particularly like this picture. Flag? Well, yeah, he was. Well, he was the executive vice president. He's still active, though. And guess who, by the way, is the new, they call it chairman or president of the NRA. Anybody know? Who? Ollie North. Remember that? Think Watergate. The new head of the NRA in terms of the, what do they call it, president or chairman or whatever, is Oliver North. Okay? But Wayne LaPierre was the executive vice president, which is to say the guy that sort of ran stuff. And he still shows up in meetings and gives speeches and so forth. I particularly like this picture because, look, the flag, right? I'm going to wrap this in the flag. It's the Constitution. And anybody that objects to our position on this clearly doesn't believe in the Constitution, right? Second Amendment, it's right there. So wrap it in the flag, and there's Capitol, and there's the White House, and this is all about, we got to preserve our constitutional rights, and anybody who's against this, hates America, hates our freedoms, is against the Constitution. Wayne LaPierre's salary in 2014, $985,000, and this is from the NRA itself, by the way. They have to file various kinds of forms. They're a 501c4. And that's important. 501c3s, like the church, are not allowed to engage in political advocacy beyond a trivial amount. 501c4s can do that. So they're not tax-exempt organizations in the way that the church is. So Wayne LaPierre was paid a little under $1 million in 2014. His salary was raised to $1,090,515 in 2015. But on top of that, he got nearly $4 million, 3.7 something, in deferred compensation. If you stick around long enough, we're going to give you this bump of additional compensation towards retirement. And he got a $150,000 bonus. So his total compensation in 2015 is $5 million, including this deferred compensation. The NRA's budget, a little over $360 million in 2016. Okay? Now, people that run big organizations get paid a lot of money in America. Is that right or wrong? We could have that discussion. I'm not interested in that discussion. My point is, does Wayne LaPierre have an interest in maintaining the position of the NRA? Yeah, you would think so, right? Now, does that mean that what they say is not true? No. You have to evaluate the substance of arguments on their merits, right? So I don't mean to suggest that just because a guy gets paid a lot to say these things, that what he says is not true. I'm not saying that at all. That would be two or three logical fallacies. I'm simply saying truthiness tends to correlate with interest, And people tend to lift up the things that they have a short-term or perhaps even longer-term self-interest in maintaining. Seems rather clear that the guy that runs or has run the NRA has an interest. Now here's another set of interests. Two gun makers' stock prices. So if you go on Fidelity, let's say, or any investment outfit, and you call up the stock price charts for, in this case, 10 years, here we have Smith & Wesson, which renamed itself American Outdoor Brands Corporation a couple years ago. And here's Sturm Ruger, which is Ruger guns. They make all kinds of guns. So here's what happened. Look at these dates. Cruising along for Smith & Wesson, this is $10 a share. So 2011, 12, it's down around, what, a little less than $5 a share, maybe? You know, 470, 80, something like that. Okay. Sturm Ruger, same period, looks like it's going for $17, $18 a share, something like that. Okay. Now, what happens? Obama's been in the White House for 4 years. Obama's running again, so now it's ramping up to 2012. Look at this. It starts to climb. Smith & Wesson starts to climb. Sturm Ruger starts to climb. Some gun companies are privately held, so you can't get stock prices. Why do you suppose around the time leading up to the 2012 presidential election, the prices of stocks for companies like Smith & Wesson and Sturm Ruger should be rising? Anybody have an idea? What? Yes, and why was the demand up? Obama's going to take your guns, right? Pure and simple. If you went on to NRA and other gun lobby websites, that's not even subtle. That was the message. Obama wants to take your guns, better buy now. I'm not making that up. I spent time on the website. That's exactly what it said. And by the way, it's a fair question to ask. I can't judge this, but it's a fair question to ask. Is it possible that there's a racial element to this too? I don't know. But there are a lot of people that think so. A lot of the people where I grew up, 20 miles south of here, put camo on the weekends and crawl around in the woods with their AR-15 equivalents and were not at all happy that a black guy was in the White House. I don't make too much of that, but I'm reasonably sure that's an element. So, here you go. Obama's running for president again. Look at this. Prices start to climb. Now, something happened. I don't know what it was. Something happened the latter part of 2014 that both Smith & Wesson and Sturm Ruger went down a bit. But, of course, who is in the White House isn't the only thing that happens to stock prices. Lots of things happen. Among other things, everybody goes out and buys guns. They don't need some anymore. There are more than 300 million guns in America, which is more than one per every house, one per every person. But they're not evenly distributed. I forget the percentage. Anybody know? A relatively small percentage of the population owns guns. So some people have lots of them. Barb?
Those are registered guns?
Yeah, registered guns, right, as opposed to the ones that people steal or, you know, whatever. Okay, so the stock prices go up. They fall off a little bit, 2014-15. So now look again. What's happening in 2015-2016? Come on. Is this the audience participation portion of our program? What's happening 2015 and 16? An election. And Hillary's running. And it turns out, when the dust settles, Donald J. Trump is running, right? Well, what's the message? Well, if you spend any time on the website, Hillary wants to take away your guns, right? And Trump's going to protect. But almost nobody thought that Trump was going to win, arguably including Trump himself. But that's another conversation. So almost everybody's assuming that Hillary Clinton is going to win. Hillary is going to take your guns. So look at this. Now, up to the latter part of 2016, which is to say the election, look, here's Smith & Wesson that had been trading a few years ago down around less than $5, is now trading at $30 six times. Appreciation sixfold in, what, 5 years? That's a pretty good return, right? Similarly, Sturm Ruger, which for some reason has a rockier thing, few years ago, trading at whatever that was, maybe 17. 10, 17, something like that. Now, peaks to $80. Again, 5 or 6 time return. That's really good. Now, what happens is, ironically, Trump's election is bad for the bad for the gun manufacturers because he's sure not going to take away your guns. And so, for one thing, all these people stocked up, afraid that Hillary's going to win and take away their guns. But now they have them. They don't need them anymore. And now they're not worried about it because Trump is sure not going to take your guns. Anybody know how much the gun lobby contributed to Trump's campaign? Correct answer would be $30 million. $30 million. Again, this I'm not making this stuff up. You can find this all over the place. And if you went to the websites, you would see the NRA straightforward support for electing Trump. So, who benefits? You always want to ask on any public policy issues. This is like day one of public policy school. You always ask who pays, who benefits, and how much, right? Well, Wayne LaPierre benefits. He makes $1 million a year, except in the year when he gets his retirement bonus, then it's $5 million. The gun manufacturers benefit. Look at that. The price of their stock multiplies 6 times in 4 or 5 years. That's a pretty good return. And by the way, if you look at the list of board members of the NRA, a fair number of them are CEOs of gun manufacturers, ammunition manufacturers, people that do stuff related to firearms. And by the way, Grover Norquist, class of 2018, Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax something fame, no net new taxes. He's also on the board, at least through this year, of the NRA. Okay? So, guns don't kill people, people kill people, but there's some questions we might ask. Is this true or is this a misleading half-truth? Because as we said before, if you're asking, can guns leap off the shelf and, you know, murder a school full of kids, of course not. Manifestly not. That would be silly. But do people with guns kill people more easily, faster, more effectively? How can you possibly deny that? The guy that was up in the hotel 31 stories across the street from the Las Vegas concert had a whole little armory of these kinds of weapons. He could not have killed all those people at the concert with a baseball bat. He could not have killed so many people before the security people figured out where the shots were coming from and finally got up and got him. He killed a whole bunch of people from 31 stories up across the street with the only kind of weapon you could do that with, which is to say, a relatively large magazine, relatively rapid fire, accurate rifle. There's no other way to do that. Okay? So, is it true that guns don't kill people, people kill people, or is that a misleading half-truth? By the way, I meant to document this, but I'm 90% sure this is true. On the day of the Sandy Hook shootings, when 20 little kids and school people got killed, coincidentally, in some weird, quirky thing of fate, there was a knife attack in China. You remember this? A comparable number of people were attacked with knives in China on the same day. I'm pretty sure this is true. It's just one of those stranger-than-fiction things. Every single one of those people lived. 20 little people died in Sandy Hook. So guns will kill people, people kill people. That feels to me like a misleading half-truth. It's astonishing to me how many people think that kind of slogan settles the question. They listen to the half of it that says guns don't do it by themselves and completely ignore the fact that without the guns, a whole lot of these people could not have been killed in the way that they were. Is the only solution more people with guns? Because, of course, that's the NRA and the gun lobby's view. Let's just get teachers to pack, right? Not their lunch. They could pack their lunch, too. Let's get them all to pack handguns, right? Because then a bad guy with a gun shows up and a good guy with a gun will stop him. Well, how's that working? Teachers' unions, on the whole, not so happy about that. Always, always ask in public policy questions, who benefits from any particular proposal? Wayne LaPierre benefits. The board members of the gun companies benefit. Board members of the NRA benefit. And all those owners who see themselves as protecting the Constitution, protecting their freedoms, they benefit. A lot of people benefit. Well, who pays? Who pays? Why should civilians own military-grade weapons? When I was 11 years old, I got a single-shot 22 caliber rifle from Sears. Probably cost my dad $20 in 1964. When I was a kid, 20-some miles from here, every boy who turned 11 got a gun. It might surprise you to hear, and you might think, wow, Jim's got all this anti-gun stuff. I actually own 5 guns. 2 of them are Rugers, by the way. This is not anti-gun. Do civilians need to own military-grade weapons? I can tell you, if you want to go deer hunting, you do not carry the Bushmaster XM15. I mean, the deer's got to have some kind of chance, right? You do not go out into the woods and spray it with your XM15 by Bushmaster. Those are not legal for hunting. They're not legal for a lot of stuff, except target practice. So if you ask sportsmen who own these things, why do you want these things? You will hear lots of answers. You'll hear, well, it's my Second Amendment right to bear arms. You will hear, I enjoy shooting. You will hear, I'm a law-abiding citizen. And what you'll only hear in certain circles, but you will hear it if you know where to listen, is in case we need to defend the country against the jackbooted thugs of the government, we need these kinds of weapons. Now, you're not going to hear that on the radio unless you have certain bands that I don't get. But if you go to the right circles, you will absolutely hear that. Now, remember, the Second Amendment says a well-ordered militia being important to the protection of the state. Some of these guys want to own these weapons precisely to protect themselves against the state because their fantasy is that the jackbooted thugs of government are going to come and take over the country and they're going to stand up and defend against it. Arguably exactly the opposite motivation for the Second Amendment, which was to protect the state against the British. So is there a good reason for civilians to own military-grade weapons? You could debate that, but one answer for sure is not hunting. Mass shooters are often law-abiding until they aren't. This is an important point. Even if you fix all the background check stuff, if you haven't gone out and done some felony, you can get a gun. If you're planning to go out and shoot a bunch of people and you haven't done it yet, you're still a law-abiding citizen in the sense that you pass the gun check and then you go 31 stories up in the hotel across the street and then you blow away a whole bunch of people at a concert. So the notion that law-abiding citizens should be able to get these things, well, law-abiding citizens are law-abiding until they're not. And if they have those kinds of weapons, they can kill a whole room full of people in a couple minutes because that's what they're made for, by the way. I said before, the army carries these things as opposed to just knives and baseball bats because they're way more effective at killing the enemy than knives and baseball bats, right? That's why the army carries them. So the argument that civilians need these things and you're law-abiding and therefore law-abiding people should have them, well, you're law-abiding until you're not anymore because you've used it to kill a bunch of people. So is there a good reason to have them? Would as many people be killed with other weapons? Shoot, we're running out of time here. Here are the FBI statistics from 2010 to 2014. I just was able to find this chart. They're a couple years behind in compiling statistics. But real briefly, look, homicides, 2010 to 2014 official FBI statistics, total homicides, not including suicides, by the way. There are actually more suicides in America than there are homicides. Did you know that? So homicides, like killing other people, not yourself. First of all, notice that they've been going down. By the way, violent crimes of all kinds on average have gone down since the early 90s to a couple years ago. There's a bit of a spike a couple years ago, but basically the story of the last 20 years was a decrease in violent crime. All right, so almost 12,000 people killed in homicides in 2014. 8,000 of those by firearms of all kinds, which is to say roughly two-thirds, 67-point-something%. Translated means more than twice as many people or about twice as many people are killed with guns than are killed with all other weapons combined. Let that sink in. Of all the homicides, two-thirds are committed with guns, which is to say a little over twice as many murders happen with guns than with all other weapons combined. You will often hear gun lobby people say, well, if they didn't have guns, they'd use knives. Well, here are knives. 1,567 people were killed by knives, which is, what, one-sixth of the number of people killed with guns? Why? Because guns are easier. I can stand here and shoot you over there. If I have a knife, I've got to get close enough for you to potentially disarm me or hit me in the face or whatever. People use guns because guns are easier to kill people with. So the notion that, well, if they didn't have guns, they would just use knives, probably not. The guy in the hotel in Las Vegas, probably not. All right, so just to give you more stuff to think about, and we're really out of time, here's a third thing, and I'm only going to put some questions up. Climate change. Is it a hoax? Some people in high places have said so. Who claims that? What are their credentials? What's their interest? If climate change is not a problem that we can and should do something about, why do most climate scientists, nearly all nations, 190-some, right? Many corporations and the Pentagon believe it is? That's a question. Who benefits from climate change denial? Who funds climate change denial spokespeople? If it turns out to be true, what will be the costs and consequences? And what will we tell our grandchildren? There's not even time to start talking about that today. But the reason that I put these three things up here is not that we're going to resolve these. It's not even to take a position on them necessarily. It's just to say, I want us to look at how people think and talk about these things and learn to ask the questions that identify people's interest, how they have a sort of truthiness about stuff that they believe, whether or not it's based on facts, and how then to see through some of that, to focus on facts, and solve some of these big, big problems. I don't think there's an easy answer to any of these things. But our purpose here is to look at how people think and talk about them in a way. Last slide. Here's Jim Clapper, really dour-looking guy. I suppose if you spent 50 years in intelligence, you would look like that. He started off in the Air Force, three-star Air Force general, did defense intelligence, Air Force intelligence, then defense intelligence. He spent 8 years, maybe, a bunch of years, as the director of national intelligence, DNI. And so he studied Russians and Chinese and all kinds of people trying to put out disinformation. Disinformation is information put out by an entity that wants to mislead people or achieve some other political objective. Here's a quotation. We're going to end on this for the moment. Getting its target audience to conclude, is a quote from the book, getting its target audience to conclude that facts and truth are unknowable is the true objective of any disinformation campaign. If somebody actually believes the falsehood, that's a bonus. But the primary objective is to get readers or viewers to throw their hands up and give up on facts. Really interesting observation. So do the climate change denialists expect you really to believe that it's a hoax? Maybe. But that's not the point. Do you remember the cigarette companies? You know, scientists are not sure. Does it really cause cancer? I don't know. There's a study that says it doesn't, right? Does the Second Amendment allow people to carry around AR-15 equivalents? We could talk about that. I'm not sure. Would cutting taxes stimulate the economy enough to, you know, pay for the deficits themselves? I don't know. Clapper's observation from 50 years in the intelligence trade is the purpose of putting out alternative interpretations of things contrary to large consensuses or apparent facts. The purpose isn't to persuade everybody that these other viewpoints are right. The purpose is just to put out enough doubt to cause people to say, how can we know? We really can't know. So you pay your money, you take your choice, you listen to your tribe, and you do whatever the people that you know and like and what they tell you on your news sources tell you to do. Clapper says the Russians are masters of this. Putin, before he became president, you know, was senior KGB guy, or then the descendant of the KGB. Putin is a master at this stuff. You watch what the Russians do. They're all about putting out things just enough to question what other people are saying is manifestly the case. That's the way disinformation works. Next week, we're going to tie it all up. I'm sorry there's not more time for conversation now, but I'm just trying to get you to see how so much of the claims that we hear, so many of the claims that we hear, are not driven by a pursuit of the facts, a pursuit of objective truth, a pursuit of what's best for everybody. It's driven by the truthiness that resonates with my tribe, and often those things run up against a significant amount of reality. What are we going to do about it? Fortunately, we have next week to figure it out. See you then.